Section 2. Rawls' Theory. We can bring our discussion of distributive justice into sharper focus by considering in some detail John Rawls' recent contribution to the subject. A theory of justice is a powerful, deep, subtle, wide-ranging, systematic work in political and moral philosophy, which has not seen its like since the writings of John Stuart Mill, if then. It is a fountain of illuminating ideas, integrated together into a lovely whole. Political philosophers now must either work within Rawls' theory or explain why not. The considerations and distinctions we have developed are illuminated by and help illuminate Rawls' masterful presentation of an alternative conception. Even those who remain unconvinced after wrestling with Rawls' systematic vision will learn much from closely studying it. I do not speak only of the Millian sharpening of one's views in combating what one takes to be error. It is impossible to read Rawls' book without incorporating much, perhaps transmuted, into one's own deepened view, and it is impossible to finish his book without a new and inspiring vision of what a moral theory may attempt to do and unite, of how beautiful a whole theory can be. I permit myself to concentrate here on disagreements with Rawls only because I am confident that my listeners will have discovered for themselves its many virtues. Social Cooperation. I shall begin by considering the role of the principles of justice. Let us assume, to fix ideas, that a society is a more or less self-sufficient association of persons who in their relations to one another recognize certain rules of conduct as binding, and who for the most part act in accordance with them. Suppose further that these rules specify a system of cooperation designed to advance the good of those taking part in it. Then, although a society is a cooperative venture for mutual advantage, it is typically marked by a conflict as well as by an identity of interests. There is an identity of interests, since social cooperation makes possible a better life for all than any would have if each were to live solely by his own efforts. There is a conflict of interests, since persons are not indifferent as to how the greater benefits produced by their collaboration are distributed, for in order to pursue their ends, they each prefer a larger to a lesser share. A set of principles is required for choosing among the various social arrangements which determine this division of advantages, and for underwriting an agreement on the proper distributive shares. These principles are the principles of social justice. They provide a way of assigning rights and duties in the basic institutions of society, and they define the appropriate distribution of the benefits and burdens of social cooperation. Let us imagine N individuals who do not cooperate together and who each live solely by their own efforts. Each person, I, receives a payoff, return, income, and so forth, S sub I. The sum total of what each individual gets acting separately is S equals the sum of S sub I, where I goes from 1 to N. By cooperating together, they can obtain a larger sum total, T. The problem of distributive social justice, according to Rawls, is how these benefits of cooperation are to be distributed or allocated. This problem might be conceived of in two ways. How is the total T to be allocated? Or how is the incremental amount due to social cooperation, that is, the benefits of social cooperation T minus S, to be allocated? The latter formulation assumes that each individual I receives from the subtotal S of T his share S sub I. The two statements of the problem differ. When combined with the non-cooperative distribution of S, each I getting S sub I, a fair-looking distribution of T minus S under the second version may not yield a fair-looking distribution of T, the first version. Alternatively, a fair-looking distribution of T may give a particular individual I less than his share, S sub I. The constraint T sub I, equal to or greater than S sub I on the answer to the first formulation of the problem, where T sub I is the share in T of the ith individual, would exclude this possibility. Rawls, without distinguishing these two formulations of the problem, writes as though his concern is the first one, that is, how the total sum T is to be distributed. One might claim, to support a focus on the first issue, that due to the enormous benefits of social cooperation, the non-cooperative shares S sub I are so small in comparison to any cooperative ones T sub I that they may be ignored in setting up the problem of social justice. Though we should note that this certainly is not how people entering into cooperation with one another would agree to conceive of the problem of dividing up cooperation's benefits. Why does social cooperation create the problem of distributive justice? Would there be no problem of justice, and no need for a theory of justice, if there was no social cooperation at all? If each person got his share solely by his own efforts? If we suppose, as Rawls seems to, that this situation does not raise questions of distributive justice, then in virtue of what facts about social cooperation do these questions of justice emerge? What is it about social cooperation that gives rise to issues of justice? It cannot be said that there will be conflicting claims only where there is social cooperation, that individuals who produce independently and initially fend for themselves will not make claims of justice on each other. If there were 10 Robinson Crusoes, each working alone for 2 years on separate islands, who discovered each other and the facts of their different allotments by radio communication via transmitters left 20 years earlier, could they not make claims on each other, supposing it were possible to transfer goods from one island to the next? Wouldn't the one with the least make a claim on ground of need, or on the ground that his island was naturally poorest, or on the ground that he was naturally least capable of fending for himself? Mightn't he say that justice demanded he be given some more by the others, claiming it unfair that he should receive so much less and perhaps be destitute, perhaps starving? He might go on to say that the different individual non-cooperative shares stem from differential natural endowments, which are not deserved, and that the task of justice is to rectify these arbitrary facts and inequities. Rather than its being the case that no one will make such claims in the situation lacking social cooperation, perhaps the point is that such claims clearly would be without merit. Why would they clearly be without merit? In the social non-cooperation situation, it might be said, each individual deserves what he gets unaided by his own efforts, or rather, no one else can make a claim of justice against this holding. It is pellucidly clear in this situation who is entitled to what, so no theory of justice is needed. On this view, social cooperation introduces a muddying of the waters that makes it unclear or indeterminate who is entitled to what. Rather than saying that no theory of justice applies to this non-cooperative case, wouldn't it be unjust if someone stole another product in the non-cooperative situation? I would say that it is a clear case of application of the correct theory of justice, the entitlement theory. How does social cooperation change things so that the same entitlement principles that apply to the non-cooperative cases become inapplicable or inappropriate to cooperative ones? It might be said that one cannot disentangle the contributions of distinct individuals who cooperate. Everything is everyone's joint product. On this joint product, or on any portion of it, each person plausibly will make claims of equal strength. All have an equally good claim, or at any rate no person has a distinctly better claim than any other. Somehow, this line of thought continues, it must be decided how this total product of joint social cooperation, to which individual entitlements do not apply differentially, is to be divided up. This is the problem of distributive justice. Don't individual entitlements apply to parts of the cooperatively produced product? First, suppose that social cooperation is based upon division of labor, specialization, comparative advantage, and exchange. Each person works singly to transform some input he receives, contracting with others who further transform or transport his product until it reaches its ultimate consumer. People cooperate in making things, but they work separately. Each person is a miniature firm. The products of each person are easily identifiable, and exchanges are made in open markets with prices set competitively, given informational constraints, and so forth. In such a system of social cooperation, What is the task of a theory of justice? It might be said that whatever holdings result will depend upon the exchange ratios or prices at which exchanges are made, and therefore that the task of a theory of justice is to set criteria for fair prices. This is hardly the place to trace the serpentine windings of theories of a just price. It is difficult to see why these issues should even arise here. People are choosing to make exchanges with other people and to transfer entitlements with no restrictions on their freedom to trade with any other party at any mutually acceptable ratio. Why does such sequential social cooperation, linked together by people's voluntary exchanges, raise any special problems about how things are to be distributed? Why isn't the appropriate, and not inappropriate, set of holdings just the one which actually occurs via this process of mutually agreed-to exchanges, whereby people choose to give to others what they are entitled to give or hold? Let us now drop our assumption that people work independently, cooperating only in sequence via voluntary exchanges, and instead consider people who work together jointly to produce something. Is it now possible to disentangle people's respective contributions? The question here is not whether marginal productivity theory is an appropriate theory of fair or just shares, but whether there is some coherent notion of identifiable marginal product. It seems unlikely that Rawls' theory rests on the strong claim that there is no such reasonably serviceable notion. Anyway, once again we have a situation of a large number of bilateral exchanges, owners of resources reaching separate agreements with entrepreneurs about the use of their resources, entrepreneurs reaching agreements with individual workers, or groups of workers first reaching some joint agreement and then presenting a package to an entrepreneur, and so forth. People transfer their holdings or labor in free markets, with the exchange ratios, prices, determined in the usual manner. If marginal productivity theory is reasonably adequate, people will be receiving, in these voluntary transfers of holdings, roughly their marginal products. Receiving this, we should note, is not the same as receiving the equivalent of what the person causes to exist or produces. The marginal product of a unit of F sub 1 with respect to factor F sub 2, dot dot dot, F sub n, is a subjunctive notion. It is the difference between the total product of F sub 1, dot dot dot, F sub n, used most efficiently as known how, given prudence about many costs in finding out the most efficient use of factors, and the total product of the most efficient use of F sub 2, dot dot dot, F sub n, along with a unit less of F sub 1. But these two different most efficient uses of F sub 2, dot dot dot, F sub n, along with a unit less of F sub 1, one with the additional unit of F sub 1, the other without it, will use them differently. And F sub 1's marginal product, with respect to the other factors, what everyone reasonably would pay for an additional unit of F sub 1, will not be what it causes, combined with F sub 2, F sub n, and the other units of F sub 1, but rather the difference it makes, the difference there would be if this unit of F sub 1 were absent and the remaining factors were organized most efficiently to cope with its absence. Thus, marginal productivity theory is not best thought of as a theory of actual produced product, of those things whose causal pedigree includes the unit of the factor, but rather as a theory of the difference subjunctively defined made by the presence of a factor. If such a view were connected with justice, it would seem to fit best with an entitlement conception. But if the notion of marginal product were so ineffective that factors' marginal products in actual situations of joint production could not be identified by hirers or purchasers of the factors, then the resulting distribution to factors would not be patterned in accordance with marginal product. Someone who viewed marginal productivity theory, where it was applicable, as a patterned theory of justice, might think that such situations of joint production and indeterminate marginal product provided an opportunity for some theory of justice to enter to determine appropriate exchange ratios. But an entitlement theorist would find acceptable whatever distribution resulted from the party's voluntary exchanges. Listeners who believe that Marx's analysis of exchange relations between owners of capital and laborers undercuts the view that the set of holdings which results from voluntary exchange is legitimate, or who believe it a distortion to term such exchanges voluntary, will find some relevant considerations adduced in Chapter 8. The questions about the workability of marginal productivity theory are intricate ones. Let us merely note here the strong personal incentive for owners of resources to converge to the marginal product, and the strong market pressures tending to produce this result. Employers of factors of production are not all dolts who don't know what they're doing, transferring holdings they value to others on an irrational and arbitrary basis. Indeed, Rawls' position on inequalities requires that separate contributions to joint products be isolable, to some extent at least. For Rawls goes out of his way to argue that inequalities are justified if they serve to raise the position of the worst-off group in the society, if without the inequalities the worst-off group would be even more worse off. These serviceable inequalities stem, at least in part, from the necessity to provide incentives to certain people to perform various activities or fill various roles that not everyone can do equally well. Rawls is not imagining that inequalities are needed to fill positions that everyone can do equally well, or that the most drudgery-filled positions that require the least skill will command the highest income. But to whom are the incentives to be paid? To which performers of what activities? When it is necessary to provide incentives to some to perform their productive activities, there is no talk of a joint social product from which no individual's contribution can be disentangled. If the product was all that inextricably joint, it couldn't be known that the extra incentives were going to the crucial persons, and it couldn't be known that the additional product produced by these now motivated people is greater than the expenditure to them in incentives. So it couldn't be known whether the provision of incentives was efficient or not, whether it involved a net gain or a net loss. But Rawls' discussion of justifiable inequalities presupposes that these things can be known, and so the claim we have imagined about the indivisible, non-partitionable nature of the joint product is seen to dissolve, leaving the reasons for the view that social cooperation creates special problems of distributive justice, otherwise not present, unclear, if not mysterious. Terms of cooperation and the difference principle. Another entry into the issue of the connection of social cooperation with distributive shares brings us to grips with Rawls' actual discussion. Rawls imagines rational, mutually disinterested individuals meeting in a certain situation, or abstracted from their other features not provided for in this situation. In this hypothetical situation of choice, which Rawls calls the original position, they choose the first principles of a conception of justice that is to regulate all subsequent criticism and reform of their institutions. While making this choice, no one knows his place in society, his class position or social status, or his natural assets and abilities, his strength, intelligence, and so forth. The principles of justice are chosen behind a veil of ignorance. This ensures that no one is advantaged or disadvantaged in the choice of principles by the outcome of natural chance or the contingency of social circumstances. Since all are similarly situated and no one is able to design principles to favor his particular condition, the principles of justice are the result of a fair agreement or bargain. What would persons in the original position agree to? Persons in the initial situation would choose two principles. The first requires equality in the assignment of basic rights and duties, while the second holds that social and economic inequalities, for example, inequalities of wealth and authority, are just only if they result in compensating benefits for everyone, and in particular for the least advantaged members of society. These principles rule out justifying institutions on the grounds that the hardships of some are offset by a greater good in the aggregate. It may be expedient, but it is not just, that some should have less in order that others may prosper. But there is no injustice in the greater benefits earned by a few, provided that the situation of persons not so fortunate is thereby improved. The intuitive idea is that since everyone's well-being depends upon a scheme of cooperation without which no one could have a satisfactory life, the division of advantages should be such as to draw forth the willing cooperation of everyone taking part in it, including those less well-situated. Yet this can be expected only if reasonable terms are proposed. The two principles mentioned seem to be a fair agreement on the basis of which those better endowed or more fortunate in their social position, neither of which we can be said to deserve, could expect the willing cooperation of others when some workable scheme is a necessary condition of the welfare of all. This second principle, which Rawls specifies as the difference principle, holds that the institutional structure is to be so designed that the worst-off group under it is at least as well off as the worst-off group, not necessarily the same group, would be under any alternative institutional structure. If persons in the original position follow the Minimax policy in making the significant choice of principles of justice, Rawls argues, they will choose the difference principle. Our concern here is not whether persons in the position Rawls describes actually would minimax and actually would choose the particular principles Rawls specifies. Still, we should question why individuals in the original position would choose a principle that focuses upon groups rather than individuals. Won't application of the minimax principle lead each person in the original position to favor maximizing the position of the worst-off individual? To be sure, this principle would reduce questions of evaluating social institutions to the issue of how the unhappiest depressive fares. Yet avoiding this by moving the focus to groups or representative individuals seems ad hoc and is inadequately motivated for those in the individual position. Nor is it clear which groups are appropriately considered. Why exclude the group of depressives or alcoholics or the representative paraplegic? If the difference principle is not satisfied by some institutional structure J, then under J, some group G is worse off than it would be under another institutional structure I that satisfies the principle. If another group F is better off under J than it would be under the I favored by the difference principle, is this sufficient to say that under J, some have less in order that others may prosper? Here one would have in mind that G has less in order that F prosper. Could one also make the same statement about I? Does F have less under I in order that G may prosper? Suppose that in a society the following situation prevailed. 1. Group G has amount A, and group F has amount B, with B greater than A. Also, things could be arranged differently so that G would have more than A and F would have less than B. The different arrangement might involve a mechanism to transfer some holdings from F to G. Is this sufficient to say, 2. G is badly off because F is well off. G is badly off in order that F be well off. F's being well off makes G badly off. G is badly off on account of F's being well off. G is not better off because of how well off F is. If so, does the truth of statement 2 depend on G's being in a worse position than F? There is yet another possible institutional structure K that transfers holdings from the worse-off group G to F, making G even more worse off. Does the possibility of K make it true to say that, under J, F is not even better off because of how well off G is? We do not normally hold that the truth of a subjunctive, as in 1, is alone sufficient for the truth of some indicative causal statement, as in 2. It would improve my life in various ways if you were to choose to become my devoted slave, supposing I could get over the initial discomfort. Is the cause of my present state your not becoming my slave? Because your enslaving yourself to a poorer person would improve his lot and worsen yours, are we to say that the poor person is badly off because you are as well off as you are? Has he less in order that you may prosper? From 3. If P were to do Act A, then Q would not be in situation S. We will conclude 4. P's not doing A is responsible for Q's being in situation S. P's not doing A causes Q to be in S. only if we also believe that 5. P ought to do Act A, or P has a duty to do Act A, or P has an obligation to do Act A, and so forth. Thus, the inference from 3 to 4 in this case presupposes 5. One cannot argue from 3 to 4 as one step in order to get to 5. The statement that in a particular situation some have less in order that others may prosper is often based upon the very evaluation of a situation or an institutional framework that it is introduced to support. Since this evaluation does not follow merely from the subjunctive, for example, 1 or 3, an independent argument must be produced for it. Though Rawls does not clearly distinguish 2 from 1 and 4 from 3, I do not claim that he makes the illegitimate step of sliding from the latter subjunctive to the former indicative. Even so, the mistake is worth pointing out because it is an easy one to fall into, and it might appear to prop up positions we argue against. Rawls holds, as we have seen, that since everyone's well-being depends upon a scheme of cooperation without which no one could have a satisfactory life, the division of advantages should be such as to draw forth the willing cooperation of everyone taking part in it, including those less well-situated. Yet this can be expected only if reasonable terms are proposed. The two principles mentioned seem to be a fair agreement on the basis of which those better endowed or more fortunate in their social position could expect the willing cooperation of others when some workable scheme is a necessary condition of the welfare of all. No doubt the difference principle presents terms on the basis of which those less well endowed would be willing to cooperate. What better terms could they propose for themselves? But is this a fair agreement on the basis of which those worse endowed could expect the willing cooperation of others? With regard to the existence of gains from social cooperation, the situation is symmetrical. The better endowed gain by cooperating with the worse endowed, and the worse endowed gain by cooperating with the better endowed. Yet the difference principle is not neutral between the better and the worse endowed. Whence the asymmetry? Perhaps the symmetry is upset if one asks how much each gains from the social cooperation. This question might be understood in two ways. How much do people benefit from social cooperation as compared to their individual holdings in a non-cooperative scheme? That is, how much is T sub I minus S sub I for each individual I? Or, alternatively, how much does each individual gain from general social cooperation, as compared not with no cooperation, but with more limited cooperation? The latter is the more appropriate question with regard to general social cooperation. For failing general agreement on the principles to govern how the benefits of general social cooperation are to be held, not everyone will remain in a non-cooperative situation if there is some other beneficial cooperative arrangement involving some, but not all, people whose participants can agree. These people will participate in this more narrow cooperative arrangement. To focus upon the benefits of the better and the worse endowed cooperating together, we must try to imagine less extensive schemes of partitioned social cooperation in which the better endowed cooperate only among themselves and the worse endowed cooperate only among themselves, with no cross-cooperation. The members of both groups gain from the internal cooperation within their respective groups and have larger shares than they would if there were no social cooperation at all. An individual benefits from the wider system of extensive cooperation between the better and the worse endowed to the extent of his incremental gain from this wider cooperation, namely the amount by which his share under a scheme of general cooperation is greater than it would be under one of limited intra-group, but not cross-group, cooperation. General cooperation will be of more benefit to the better or to the worse endowed if, to pick a simple criterion, the mean incremental gain from general cooperation, when compared with limited intra-group cooperation, is greater in one group than it is in the other. One might speculate about whether there is an inequality between the group's mean incremental gains, and if so, which way it goes. If the better endowed group includes those who manage to accomplish something of great economic advantage to others, such as new inventions, new ideas about production or ways of doing things, skill at economic tasks, and so on, it is difficult to avoid concluding that the less well-endowed gain more than the better-endowed do from the scheme of general cooperation. They needn't be better-endowed from birth. In the context in which Rawls uses it, all better-endowed means is accomplishes more of economic value, able to do this, has a high marginal product, and so forth. The role that unpredictable factors play in this complicates imagining a prior partitioning of the two groups. The text follows Rawls in categorizing persons as better and worse endowed only in order to criticize the considerations he adduces for his theory. The entitlement theory does not rest upon any assumption that the classification is an important one, or even a possible one, or upon any elitist presupposition. Since the entitlement theorist does not accept the patterned principle, to each according to his natural endowment, he can easily grant that what an exercised endowment brings in the market will depend upon the endowments of others and how they choose to exercise them, upon the market-expressed desires of buyers, upon the alternate supply of what he offers, and of what others may substitute for what he offers, and upon other circumstances summing the myriad choices and actions of others. Similarly, we saw earlier that the similar considerations Rawls adduces about the social factors upon which the marginal product of labor depends, Theory of Justice, page 308, will not faze an entitlement theorist, even though they might undercut the rationale put forth by a proponent of the patterned principle of distribution according to marginal product. What follows from the conclusion that the less well-endowed gain more than the better-endowed do from the scheme of general cooperation? I do not mean to imply that the better-endowed should get even more than they get under the entitlement system of general social cooperation. What does follow from the conclusion is a deep suspicion of imposing, in the name of fairness, constraints upon voluntary social cooperation and the set of holdings that arises from it, so that those already benefiting most from this general cooperation benefit even more. Supposing they could identify themselves and each other, they might try to exact a larger share by banding together as a group and bargaining jointly with the others. Given the large numbers of persons involved and the incentive for some of the better endowed individuals to break ranks and reach separate agreements with the worse endowed, if such a coalition of the better endowed is unable to impose sanctions on its defectors, it will dissolve. The better endowed remaining in the coalition may use boycott as a sanction and refuse to cooperate with a defector. To break the coalition, those less well endowed would have to be able to offer someone better endowed sufficient incentive to defect to make up for his loss through no longer being able to cooperate with the other better endowed persons. Perhaps it would pay for someone to defect from the coalition only as part of a sizable group of defectors, which defecting group the initial coalition might try to keep small by special offers to individuals to defect from it, and so on. The problem is a complicated one, further complicated by the obvious fact, despite our use of Rawls' classificatory terminology, that there is no sharp line of cleavage between the endowments of people to determine which groups would form. Rawls would have us imagine the worse endowed person say something like the following: "Look, better endowed, you gain by cooperating with us. If you want our cooperation, you'll have to accept reasonable terms. We suggest these terms. We'll cooperate with you only if we get as much as possible. That is, the terms of our cooperation should give us that maximal share such that if it was tried to give us more, we'd end up with less." How generous these proposed terms are might be seen by imagining that the better endowed make the almost symmetrical opposite proposal. "Look, worse endowed, you gain by cooperating with us. If you want our cooperation, you'll have to accept reasonable terms. We propose these terms. We'll cooperate with you as long as we get as much as possible. That is, the terms of our cooperation should give us the maximal share such that if it was tried to give us more, we'd end up with less." If these terms seem outrageous, as they are, why don't the terms proposed by those worse endowed seem the same? Why shouldn't the better endowed treat this latter proposal as beneath consideration, supposing someone to have the nerve explicitly to state it. Rawls devotes much attention to explaining why those less well-favored should not complain at receiving less. His explanation, simply put, is that because the inequality works for his advantage, someone less well-favored shouldn't complain about it. He receives more in the unequal system than he would in an equal one, though he might receive still more in another unequal system that placed someone else below him. But Rawls discusses the question of whether those more favored will or should find the term satisfactory only in the following passage, where A and B are any two representative men, with A being the more favored. The difficulty is to show that A has no grounds for complaint. Perhaps he is required to have less than he might, since his having more would result in some loss to B. Now, what can be said to the more favored man? To begin with, it is clear that the well-being of each depends on a scheme of social cooperation, without which no one could have a satisfactory life. Secondly, we can ask for the willing cooperation of everyone only if the terms of the scheme are reasonable. The difference principle, then, seems to be a fair basis on which those better endowed, or more fortunate in their social circumstances, could expect others to collaborate with them when some workable arrangement is a necessary condition of the good of all. What Rawls imagines being said to the more favored men does not show that these men have no grounds for complaint, nor does it at all diminish the weight of whatever complaints they have. That the well-being of all depends on social cooperation, without which no one could have a satisfactory life, could also be said to the less well-endowed by someone proposing any other principle, including that of maximizing the position of the best endowed. Similarly, for the fact that we can ask for the willing cooperation of everyone only if the terms of the scheme are reasonable. The question is, what terms would be reasonable? What Rawls imagines being said thus far merely sets up his problem. It doesn't distinguish his proposed difference principle from the almost symmetrical counterproposal that we imagined the better endowed making, or from any other proposal. Thus, when Rawls continues, "The difference principle then seems to be a fair basis on which those best endowed, or more fortunate in their social circumstances, could expect others to collaborate with them when some workable arrangement is a necessary condition of the good of all," the presence of the then in his sentence is puzzling. Since the sentences which precede it are neutral between his proposal and any other proposal, the conclusion that the difference principle presents a fair basis for cooperation cannot follow from what precedes it in this passage. Rawls is merely repeating that it seems reasonable, hardly a convincing reply to anyone to whom it doesn't seem reasonable. I treat Rawls' discussion here as one concerning better and worse endowed individuals who know they are so. Alternatively, one might imagine that these considerations are to be weighed by someone in the original position. If I turn out to be better endowed, then... If I turn out to be worse endowed, then... But this construal will not do. Why would Rawls bother saying, "The two principles seem to be a fair agreement on the basis of which those better endowed or more fortunate in their social position could expect the willing cooperation of others"? Theory of Justice, page 15. Who is doing the expecting when? How is this to be translated into subjunctives to be contemplated by someone in the original position? Similarly, questions arise about Rawls saying, "The difficulty is to show that A has no grounds for complaint. Perhaps he is required to have less than he might, since his having more would result in some loss to B. Now, what can be said to the more favored man? The difference principle then seems to be a fair basis on which those better endowed could expect others to collaborate with them." Theory of Justice, page 103. Are we to understand this as someone in the original position wonders what to say to himself as he then thinks of the possibility that he will turn out to be one of the better endowed? And does he then say that the difference principle then seems a fair basis for cooperation, despite the fact that, and even while he is contemplating the possibility that he is better endowed? Or does he say then that even later, if and when he knows he is better endowed, the difference principle will seem fair to him at that later time? And when are we to imagine him possibly complaining? Not while in the original position, for then he is agreeing to the difference principle. Nor does he worry, while in the process of deciding in the original position, that he will complain later, for he knows that he will have no cause to complain later at the effects of whatever principle he himself rationally will choose soon in the original position. Are we to imagine him complaining against himself? And isn't the answer to any later complaint, "You agreed to it, or you would have agreed to it if so originally positioned"? What difficulty does Rawls concern himself with here? Trying to squeeze it into the original position makes it completely mysterious. And what is thinking of what is a fair agreement, section 3, or a fair basis, page 103, doing here anyway, in the midst of the rational, self-interested calculations of persons in the original position, who do not then knowingly possess, or at any rate utilize, particular moral notions? I see no coherent way to incorporate how Rawls treats and speaks of the issue of the terms of cooperation between the better and the worse endowed into the structure and perspective of the original position. Therefore, my discussion considers Rawls here as addressing himself to individuals outside the original position, either to better endowed individuals or to his readers, to convince them that the difference principle which Rawls extracts from the original position is fair. It is instructive to compare how Rawls imagines justifying the social order to a person in the worst-off group in an unequal society. Rawls wants to tell this person that the inequalities work out to his advantage. This is told to someone who knows who he is. The social order can be justified to everyone, and in particular to those who are least favored, page 103. Rawls does not want to say, "You would have gambled, and you lost," or any such thing, even, "You chose it, then in the original position," nor does he wish merely to address someone in the original position. He also wants a consideration apart from the original position that will convince someone who knows of his inferior position in an unequal society. To say, "You have less in order that I may prosper," would not convince someone who knows of his inferior position, and Rawls rightly rejects it, even though its subjunctive analog for someone in the original position, if we could make sense of this, would not be without force. Rawls has not shown that the more favored man, A, has no grounds for complaint at being required to have less in order that another, B, might have more than he otherwise would. And he can't show this, since A does have grounds for complaint, doesn't he?